Hello, I'm Mark DeLuzio. Over the past century, our constitutional republic, grounded in the rule of law, has been transformed into a tyrannical democracy, orchestrated by unelected bureaucrats and globalists. The Constitution is now treated as a suggestion, not the law of the land. Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God.
Hi, I'm Mark's co-host, Suzette Lawrence. Our intention is to explore the Constitution and discuss how our freedoms and constitutional rights are violated by those very politicians who took an oath on the Bible to uphold it. Learn how the Constitution is the solution to our country's problems. What do we need to do to restore our inalienable and enumerated rights? Class begins now.
Welcome to episode 23 with Suzette Lawrence from Sedona, Arizona. How are you doing, Suzette?
I'm doing great, Mark. How are you doing? It's freezing up here.
Well,
I mean, we're going to get snow tonight again, maybe.
You know what's crazy? People don't get that with Arizona. Like 2 hours from where I am in Scottsdale is Flagstaff, which is 7,000 feet above sea level, and people go skiing there. And I tell people that if I dropped them in a helicopter with a blindfold in the middle of Flagstaff, you probably would guess you're in Vermont, right? With all the pine trees. And people don't get that about Arizona, that, you know, it's not all, you know,
desert and hot.
Yeah. Yeah,
I know. Exactly. So it's, I did go for my morning hike, so I'm feeling good. and it was cold, which was not cold, but, you know, nice brisk wind. So I'm all ready to tackle.
Speaking of cold, you're going to take us to an introduction of the Federal Reserve today. When I say cold, every time I think about the Federal Reserve, I shudder in cold, you know, things go through my spine. And it's like, it's incredible how badly these guys have, what they have done to our country, right? But I think this episode is going to focus on, and we'll get a little into that, but you're going to try to bring people up to speed as to what this thing is called the Federal Reserve and why we have it and why people thought we needed it, and even a little bit of history as to why some of our founders didn't want something like this called the central bank and all that. And this is also going to tie a little bit into a couple of things, Suzette. It's going to tie into the first episode we had, one of the first episodes we had called Constitutional Economics.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk a little bit about that. It's going to tie in something we're going to call the gold standard, which we're going to actually do a full episode on that in the future, probably maybe more than one. We're going to do an episode on the Depression and FDR and how the Federal Reserve and what role they played in that, and why removing the gold standard in 1972 with President Nixon was the reason why you're paying $6 for a loaf of bread today. Okay. And we'll talk all about that in a lot more granularity, but your goal today is to help us think through the history and, you know, what is all this about this Federal Reserve? What is it? And how does it work? And all that good stuff. So I will turn it over to you, and I'll pipe in once in a while with a comment here and there. And we'll go from there. I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Well, thank you, Mark. This is a very big topic. So that's why we've broken it down the way that we have. So we're just kind of doing an intro today.
Right.
And the so I want to kind of start at the beginning. You know, the first central bank was in the Netherlands in 1609. So this was not a new idea. And everyone that understood history knew that central banks could fund empires and armies. And this was very distressing to the founders who, like Thomas Jefferson said, armies, debts, and taxes are the known instruments putting the many under the domination of the few. So think about that. You know, think about in your own life, you don't even have to think of the big Federal Reserve System, but in your own life, the person that has the money is the person that's making the decisions. So,
you know, it's interesting you say that, Suzette, because, you know, one of the earlier episodes We talked about constitutional basics. And one of the things we talked about was the notion of freedom and personal property and how that ties together. Your personal property, which in this case is money. Okay. It's also your house, your car, and all that. But money is personal property. And the founders understood there's a direct correlation between that and your freedom. And let me give you a real layman's example. Well, let me give you a layman's example. I mean, the freedom to be able to take a vacation once or twice a year with your family is based on money. If you don't have the money to take that vacation, you're not going to do it. Okay. So in that sense, your freedom is limited in that regard. Or whether or not you're buying that choice steak or chicken is determined on money. And money is a way that the federal government attempts to control people, their citizens. And by taking money from one and giving it to another, which is unconstitutional, by the way, is a way that they control you. And when that happens, they control both parties. Okay. So this is a little bit more granularity behind why the founders in your example were feeling that way. They knew. These guys had wisdom that was off the charts. Okay.
Oh yeah. This was not new. This was not a new idea. You
Crazy.
Know, we were a new country, and you know, Thomas Jefferson's idea of freedom was that everyone could like speak freely, have free thoughts, bring to the marketplace their idea of free thought. Everybody could have a garden and a home, have a little property so that they could feed themselves. This was it now. And in the modern world, you know, it's amazing how many people think food comes from the grocery store. But in the real world, we know that's not true. You know, that the grocery store is just one stop along a very long road of producing food.
Right.
And the homeless and the hungry will tell you that, you know. So we're not that, I hope that makes sense, you know, that the freedom, liberty, the ability to eat, be, you know, have your head under a roof, be able to
send your kids to school. I mean go down the list of things that you do with money. And it's directly, and they understood it's directly tied to your personal freedoms, right? And so that's why there's a protection of your personal property in the Constitution. But anyway,
okay,
I just
want
to point out. So, okay, excellent.
And then the John Adams also said, all perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise not from want of honor or virtue. Like nobody's wringing their hands because they weren't their best person today, but from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. Mm-hmm. John Adams said that. And think about that. Like in your high school, in elementary school, did you ever take a class on money and how to manage money, how to have a bank account, how to save money, what money was? We're just ignorant when it comes to money. And he's saying that this is a huge problem and that, you know, we have to, he's just identifying the problem. So in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10 says it limits what states can do regarding money. So this is no state is allowed to coin money. They can only use gold and silver, originally gold and silver coins, as a tender in the payment of debts.
Mm-hmm.
And no state can emit bills of credit, which would be essentially IOUs or paper money.
Correct.
So this was not.
By the way, Section 10, Article 1, Section 8. Has one of the 18 enumerated powers of Congress is that Congress has the power to coin money. Now, coin money didn't say print money. It said coin money. That's maybe a subject
right.
for another day.
Money is always gold and silver in real language. In modern language, it's, you know, a a credit card is money. But in real life, gold and silver are money. And that's why the Federal Reserve and these big federal banks and central banks around the world in every country have gold. You know, they don't, anyway. So that's, so we know that the founders knew all about central banking from this, from the Dutch Bank of 1609, from the Bank of England in 1694. They had a central bank for the first time. And the founders understood the problems with these things. I mean, we fought a war to be free of this kind of tyranny and oppression. In 1791 to 1811, we had the first bank of the United States, which was a national bank. And that was led, that argument was led by Hamilton and a Federalist Congress. So we had these congressmen who were really into the central bank or the central government type of thing. So you have the more liberal, and by liberal, I mean independent people that felt like we shouldn't have central control versus people like Hamilton and the Federalists who felt like we needed to have a national bank.
And by the way, let me interrupt you for a minute. For the listeners out there, when Suzette uses the word Federalist in this regard, Federalists were people like Hamilton and Adams who believed more in a larger government than the Madisonians and Jeffersons, if you will, and John Jays, that believed in a smaller, limited government. Now, where the Constitution ended up was more towards the latter of the Madisonian view, where the federal government is a limited government, which we're not today, by the way. And we talked a lot about that in prior episodes. I won't go through that again. But Hamilton and Adams were the people that pretty much were the guys that, and his son, John Quincy, were all Federalist, okay? And Adams and Jefferson were good friends. And this one issue divided them for the rest of their lives to the day they died. They all died on the same day, July 4th. They both died on the same day, Adams and Jefferson, and which was exactly 50 years after the signing of the Declaration. So they died in 1826. Did I get that right? Yeah. And so this was a really big deal back then. So everybody thinks that the founders were all singing kumbaya and holding hands. They fought like cats and dogs over stuff like this. But we ended up with a limited government framework based on the Adam Smith invisible hand, the Wealth of Nations, if you will, which was printed in 1776, type of government. But we've drifted so far away from the Jeffersonian and the Madisonian view of our government. And that, and a big reason for that is exactly what Suzette's bringing to us today, which is the Federal Reserve. But anyway, turn it back to you.
Okay. So they had a 20-year charter, and those are, thank you so much for interjecting because it's so important. So the first Bank of the United States was based on Great Britain's National Bank. So you can imagine that a lot of people didn't like that. Hamilton wanted the government to develop bank branches in major cities, have a uniform currency, and a place for the federal government to deposit or borrow money when they needed to. And Jefferson just said, hey, the National Bank is unconstitutional. And one of the arguments, and this is like, just imagine this. Many of the Europeans held U.S. bank stocks, especially the English. Mm-hmm. So they were like, hey, we have control after all by having bank stocks. We can make a lot of money. You know, they wanted to tax us for without representation on paper goods, the Stamp Act, which led us into the our revolution, the American Revolution, to break away from their tyranny. Mm-hmm. And now, with the central bank, the national bank, I should say, the English are saying, hey, can we own stock in this? This is almost as good. You know, we don't have any of the responsibility. We can do this hidden. We can just make the money. And that's what they did. So mm-hmm. they were very, when that charter is, again, the Constitution says that, and this was Thomas Jefferson saying that the government does not have the authority to establish corporations, including a national bank. So,
you know, he was so pure. I mean, again, who would establish that? That would be Congress. So you go to Article 1, Section 8, and look at the 18 enumerated powers of Congress, and that is not listed. Okay? So to pass legislation to actually start a corporation, which we did in 1913, which is the Federal Reserve Act, is unconstitutional.
No question.
And you know, Susan, I just don't understand how we can allow this to happen if the system really works with the Supreme Court and all that, right? But, I mean, Jefferson was right on the money.
He was. And, you know, the purpose, so the argument for the bank, and this is what Alexander Hamilton was arguing for, he was the Treasury Secretary at the time,
right,
was that the bank would be able to lend the government money and safely hold its deposits. Because up until then, they had to go to, like, other countries, like, you know, the French to borrow money, or the Spanish. I don't know if we ever borrowed from the Spanish. I know we borrowed from the French. And I know Jefferson bought a huge tract, the whole Louisiana territory, from the French, you know? So we needed a money solution, but the founders did not believe, well, the more independent-minded founders, the Jeffersons, the Madisons, did not believe it should be money should be centrally controlled, and the reason was that the moneyed interest tended to be in the North, where the Southern states were more agrarian, so they didn't like that particular feature. They knew it wouldn't be fair, so he really, but Hamilton really pushed this, and he was able to get it through. So they got in, they got this first national bank for 20 years. But Andrew Jackson, was it Andrew Jackson?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Andrew Jackson. Oh no, I'm getting ahead of myself. We don't hear much about the War of 1812, but in 1811, when that bank was not, when the charter was not extended, the next year we were invaded by England.
Mm-hmm.
So they had their money cut off. So they decided they were coming back to try and take land. And of course they didn't. And Andrew Jackson was a big factor in that. He fought viciously to protect the country. And he did win with next to no one. I mean, he had like a couple thousand guys, and they fought off the English.
By the way, just aside, Suzette, you know, you ever see on TV the man on the street, you know, questions and interviews, and they'll go up to some college kid, you know, with a history degree, and say to him, what year was the War of 1812 fought?
I don't know.
1776. Was it in, I swear to God, I kid you not. It's like scary. Anyway, I digress. Go ahead.
So the British invaded the next year, just in case anybody's doubting that the fact that there was no longer an income source from the New World, that didn't make some people angry, and they weren't going to take what they couldn't taken yep. money before, mm-hmm. they were now going to take back in land.
Mm-hmm.
So 1816 to 1836, we get a second national bank of the U.S. And the reason was, yeah, they had to pay for the War of 1812. So Jackson, like Jefferson and Madison, thought that the Bank of the United States was unconstitutional. And when Congress voted to extend the second bank's charter, So he's the seventh president, right? So he's the president near the end of that charter.
Right.
And he's saying, I am not going to sign this. There is no way that I'm going to veto this. We do. It is not right to have a national bank. He it was a huge controversy at the time. And in this case, he's very clear. He is anti-federalist in that. And if you go, there's a great, his entire speech, if you type in bank veto 1832, the Miller Center has the entire speech, which will educate all of us more profoundly on what exactly was at stake. And essentially what President Jackson was saying, and I'm going to read this, was that he passionately rejects the bill that recharters the Bank of the United States. He argues that the bank gives privilege and unfair advantage to a wealthy few at the expense of the public. And he opposes foreign ownership of bank stock. The president claims the same right to intercept the Constitution as Congress. So the president is saying, you know, I can do this. I can veto this bill because I have the power as the executive, in the same way that the Congress does in the Supreme Court. And he questions the constitutionality of it. So that was Andrew Jackson. He's on the $20 bill, which many say is, you know, he would be furious about that. He would not be happy. He would have loved being on a silver dollar or gold, you know, a $20 gold piece or a $10 gold piece, but not a paper money. So let's get back to, like, you know, we need some kind, every country needs some kind of stable currency. And currency is not money. Currency is like a dollar bill. So it's a way, it's an exchange of something that will exchange value. So the problem that persists was that even rumors of insolvency, your bank did not have to be insolvent because there were lots of banks, you know, in the country, but you didn't have to be insolvent to have a bank run. And that's where we've all watched, like, It's a Wonderful Life or, you know, different movies where people hear that a bank is going under and they line up to get their money and the banks is paying them out till they have no more money. And these bank run, and the reason that is because when banks take in money, you go to the bank, you deposit $10 into the bank. You put $2 in your savings account. You have $8. You decide you're going to keep $2 in your pocket. And now you have $6 in your checking account. And you can write checks against that $6, right? But the bank, what the bank does is they can, believe it or not, they can loan out up to 90% of your deposit. So you put $10 in, they can loan out $9. Even though maybe you have $2 in savings and maybe you put $2 in your pocket. So they can loan out more than they have on hand. And if everybody shows up to get their money, the bank is going to go bankrupt. So we were having these bank runs regularly. There was a panic in 1857. 16 years later, there was a panic in 1873. There was a panic in 1884. There was a panic in 1893. That was like just 9 years later. 3 years later in 1896, there was another panic. And then the mother of all panics was when San Francisco burned in 1906. There was an earthquake and there were fires and et cetera. And the economy just went nuts. 50% crash in the stock market. Lost 50% of its value. And the bank runs were long, painful, and that one was particularly a very painful recovery. So there were, you know, it was very difficult to overcome these things. And even today, I hope that makes sense. Like, you know, the bank goes under, all your, you know, some people got their money, some people didn't get their money. And now those people that didn't get their money have to recover. you know, and it's a,
there's a ripple effect throughout the economy.
And today they say that for every 1% of unemployment, 40,000 deaths result. For every 1%, people get depressed, they start drinking, they start using drugs, they commit suicide. How many people have we heard of that, you know, took their lives because of money? I mean, anyway, I'm just saying it's a big issue. And this is a big problem. And lots of smart people are looking at it, and they're looking at it differently. Okay. So,
by the way, before you go on there, Susan, you know, one of the things, because I know I think you're going to get into the Federal Reserve Act, where the Federal Reserve got born. One of the things I will say is, I think everybody probably knows out there that their bank deposits are guaranteed up to $250,000, right?
Correct, per account.
Per account, so to prevent those runs, okay? Well, that then allowed the banks to take more risk in who they lend money to. Okay, and that's not a good thing. See, there's always these ill-intended consequences when the government gets involved in the free market. Okay, in this case, the free market of money, right? And so the reason the banks could be in these predicaments is because they got the Fed backing them up. And so I can be a little bit more risky now in terms of what I lend Suzette. Maybe I can only lend you $70,000, but you know what? I'm going to give you $100,000 because I know I got coverage on the Federal Reserve if there's ever a run. So you know, that is a problem. And there's always these problems, these what I call unintended consequences when it comes to any of these government schemes. That's what I'm going to call this, a scheme. Okay, well, I'll stop there, but
it was a scheme. So what ends up happening? So in 1907, the big banker, the big money man, was J.P. Morgan, and people came to him for help, and he helped them. You know, he loaned money. He saw, in my view, he didn't give them money. He loaned them money. So he started putting together this Federal Reserve system in 1907. Okay, so this was, and he did this. There are a lot of people wanting to have a central bank. Senator Aldridge was one. There were all of these other, like Warburg, you know, very the moneyed men of Wall Street wanted to have a central bank. And they got together, and this is a great read. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin, if you want to do a deep dive into this. And it's about how they secretly planned, and they did it secretly. They got into Senator Aldridge's private train car in November of, I think, 1907. And they were going, quote unquote, duck hunting. They only used their first name so that no one would recognize who they were, even in front of the servants on the train. They were very secretive about this because even the rumor, keep this in mind, even the rumor of a banking insolvency could cause bank runs. So they didn't want to cause trouble, and they wanted to do this secretly because they had already met and had a pretty good idea about how they could set up a Federal Reserve system. So that was the beginning of the system. That was 1907.
Hey, by the way, Suzette, when we talk about all these different things on this podcast, whether we're talking about the military-industrial complex, whether or not talking about the Federal Reserve or anything else for that matter, all these things touch each other. They're one big colossal Venn diagram. And we start talking about, we had an episode earlier on with Christy on Marxism and globalism, okay? The people that you're mentioning, you know, J.P. Morgan, Henry Ford, all these big industrialists, I think there's evidence to suggest right now they're all globalists.
Okay? Oh, there's no question.
And there was a globalist movement back then, and this is part of it. This is part of it.
You know, these are people that were raised thinking that emperors, prime ministers, kings, you know, were, they wanted to be king. They wanted to, they wanted to try and reinvent that.
They were the smartest guys in the room. They knew better than you, you peasant, you. And if you think about that attitude still persists today, if you look at people like John Kerry and Klaus Schwab, who basically get together at Davos every year and say, this, it's amazing how this elite group of thinkers can come together and solve the world's problems like climate change as they fly in on their corporate jet, who espouse that every nation should copy the ways of China. Okay, we got CEOs like this in Silicon Valley. Tim, what's his name, of Apple, okay, thinks China should be the model for the United States. He came out and said this, okay?
Oh,
all right, these guys are globalists.
They're
and
communists.
So the JP Morgans of the world, well, communists, absolutely. The JP, that is basically what these guys are, and they're pushing for. And so the JP Morgans and Henry Fords and all these other industrialists are now replaced by these guys in Silicon Valley. Bill Gates, you know, you go back to Apple CEO, God, I can't remember his last name. It's Tim something or other. But and you talk about all these Zuckerbergs, all these globalists now sit in the information technology area, which is a real problem because they now have a lot more weapons than the industrialists did back then. The industrialists you're talking about, their weapon was money. Now you've got these Silicon Valley clowns that not only have money as a weapon, and Mark Zuckerberg showed that in the last election, where he poured in $450 million into these key precincts, but they also have information at their fingertips that they can control us in that. And that's something that the JP Morgans did not have back then. Okay, so, I mean, they might have had the press and all that, but nowhere near as effective as it is now with what we got today with social media. Because look, all these social media platforms, you know, and by the way, I don't trust Elon Musk. I'm sorry, I don't trust him. Everybody's on his bandwagon about how great he is because of what he did with Twitter. Beware of wolves in sheep's clothing, okay? Because that could have been a ploy, okay? And allowing us to him to become disarming to us. That's going back to The Art of War, okay, by Su Tung. And so we're gonna accept him in now. Well, my litmus test was in question with him, and it went right down the tubes when he met with the leader of China, Xi Jinping, right? And when he went with him, when Elon Musk met with him, right there, I said, that's it. Case closed. I don't trust the guy.
Well,
okay?
And the Google president, there were three, I think, big tech people. Elon was one of them that everybody thought that Xi Jinping flew to San Francisco to meet with President Biden. But in fact, he was there to meet with Elon Musk, the president of Google, and someone else. I don't think it was the Facebook Instagram guy.
I think it was Bill Gates too, wasn't it? But
yeah, it was probably Bill Gates. Yeah. I know. And the whole purpose was to teach them about the credit score, the social credit score, because they want to introduce that central bank digital currency. But I digress. Let's get back to the Federal Reserve. So it's 1913.
And by the way, that will be part of our future episodes on this. The central bank's digital currency, and they just put that into India. I could tell you about that someday too. But anyway, go ahead.
So we're between 1907 and 1913.
Right.
Woodrow Wilson has been essentially selected to run. They were doing that back then. They wanted him to win. So the only way they could was to split the Republican vote. So they had Teddy Roosevelt run, and I forget who he was running with. Do you remember in 1912 election? But whatever.
I don't remember, but you were there. So why don't you tell us?
But Woody runs, and he runs against the central bank. You know, this is one of his things. He's going to, you know, fix the child labor, and he's going to trust bust, and he's going to not have a federal bank. And with it in 1913, like with it, literally, he came into office in March, and by December, he was signing the Federal Reserve Act.
Yep. Hey, by the way, did I hear you right? Did you call him Woody?
I did. Oh, I forgot.
How
I try to show respect and not
how disrespectful
institute
can you be?
My bias too much because, he was a real hen.
I kept getting tongue-tied on Woodrow, okay? And and if you listen to the first episode that Suzette did on Woodrow Wilson, what name is that anyway? Anyway, I started calling him Woody. And yeah, Suzette was not, and you were not going to do that. You said, no, out of respect, I'm going to call him Woodrow Wilson. Now you just call him Woody. And I think that's a sign of growth for you, okay? But anyway, let's move on. I thought I'd point that out to the listeners.
So in 1913, when the bank first opened, right, they said, we're going to have this system. It's going to help to it will be the lender of last resort to banks that are in trouble. And it will be based on gold and commercial paper. So commercial paper, I'm pretty sure what they were talking, were they talking about treasury bonds, Mark? Is that what they meant by commercial paper?
Well, that is before the gold standard was taken away in 72, treasury bonds were a way that the Fed technically printed money. Okay, so yes, that's kind of how that worked. So
and the national banks, what they would do is say you take your silver dollar in, and the silver dollar is worth, I don't know, 13 of these banknotes. So you would get a banknote that would say it's worth two silver dollars. And right. then you could use that to shop, but the bank still had your silver, right?
Right. And so basically the currency was backed by something of value.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if it was well managed, then you know, you were successful. If you got a little drunk and greedy, drunk with power and greed, then you were unsuccessful, or you could just have bad luck. You know, I mean, my grandfather used to, he had a factory in Nuremberg, Germany in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he made mill machines, and he would loan. So he made the machines, but he was also a miller. He was milling wheat seed. And he would loan, and there were times when people couldn't afford the seed. And he would give them seed, you know, so he would credit them. And sometimes they couldn't pay him back. And usually they could, because even if it was 2 or 3 years later, he could handle the debt. So, but he had to be very careful about that so that he didn't go out of business, right? He was so popular. I have to put in this plug for my grandfather, because I just want to show everybody there are other ways than doing this through a central bank, okay? Private people can extend credit. And what my grandfather did was he extended credit to farmers, and when they could, they paid him back. Mm-hmm. When I moved to Germany in 1971, I was there for 3 years, and my mother took me to some of these farm villages that she remembered from her childhood, and these were farmers that knew my grandfather, and she called on them, and they were all giving me like 100 mark piece. They were giving me money. They were like, your grandfather saved our family. We would not have this farm if it hadn't been for him.
Amazing.
So, yeah. So this is 60 years later, 70 years later, 80 years, 70 years later, you know, they're giving me money.
That's amazing.
Because they realized, you know, because he saved them. So I thought that was pretty amazing.
I'm just wondering why you haven't given me any money since I've known you. I mean,
you haven't saved me, Mark.
Oh, I thought I did, but okay. Hey, by the way, let me just give you 1 second, okay? Just to kind of go back to Money 101, okay?
Yes.
One of the reasons for this currency is to actually facilitate the economy. Okay. So right. If there's no currency, and I'm going way back to the Stone Ages, but if there's no currency, let's just say that, Suzette, you're going to mow my lawn, but I got to pay you back. Okay. So I'm going to come over and clean your windows. Okay. Right. The economy just is so hard to barter. That's called bartering, which, by the way, for you people out there in tax land, that is a taxable transaction.
When did it become taxable?
Oh,
it was something
know,
that but, was added later know, because...
But bartering is a taxable thing where, hey, you paint my house and I'll tar your driveway. Well, that's income for both parties, and now the IRS will tax that. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at, though, is the reason we have this money... currency, if you will, is to facilitate the smooth transaction of goods and services. So I could just hand Suzette $100 because she came over and mowed my lawn, okay, and we're done, okay? That's an easy transaction. Now, she could take that $100 and go spend it on somebody to clean her windows, okay, or whatever, right, do her taxes, whatever it may be. So I just want to let people know, why did money come into existence to begin with is to facilitate transactions in the economy. And that's really what it was. And it was a necessary, if you will, evil to grow the economy too. So I just thought I'd deviate and just bring that out there. But this money, though, to have confidence in it has to be backed by something. And that's where the founders created the gold standard. Now, I don't want to get too much into the gold standard, but that will be a part of future episodes that tie back into this whole Federal Reserve discussion.
So in 1982 is when bartering became taxable.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Up until that, if you were poor, my uncle was a physician and people used to come to him because he would not turn anyone away. Okay. He saw every patient. And some people didn't have money or insurance. This was before insurance was even that big of a thing.
I'll bring a sack of potatoes. Yeah. You know.
Oh,
yeah,
he never, yeah. My aunt never cleaned her house.
Yeah.
He never, you know, somebody would come and pick up his car and take it and change the oil and take it. I mean, he was just covered, but he didn't make a lot of money. And that's another way to have a more personal, you know, extending personal credit and bartering is a very, very powerful economic tool for the everyday person, but it cuts the federal government out of your income. And they don't like that. So
I'm surprised it took them that long to tax it. I mean, 82, that's a long time after the tax code. The income tax at least was created in 1913. Or 16.
Oh, 17. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so it's been around okay. for a long time.
Yeah.
So okay. Anyway, so we have the Federal Reserve Act of, let's see.
1913. Yeah.
Of 1913. And the idea at that point is to just stabilize money and to be the lender of last resort. Well, then we get the Federal Reserve I'm looking at my notes here. There we go. The Federal Reserve Reform Act of 1977. Now, the gold window closed in 71. So if we owed a country money, they could collect in gold. Okay. That was essentially because that was money has always been gold and silver. And the French came, didn't the French, De Gaulle sent his ships to New York to pick up his gold. And Nixon said, no way, no gold for you. And so the Federal Reserve Reform Act of 1977 said that we needed reform because we needed to expand the role of the Fed to promote maximum employment, to increase production, and for price stability. Now, these are people that consider price stability to keep inflation at about 2%. And they're not beneath changing the equation to keep it at 2%. So up until about 1980, and shadowstats.com goes into this, there's an economist there, John Williams, who has tracked this. that in 1980, they took gasoline and food out of the equation to calculate the CPI, the consumer price index. So how much does it cost you to run your family, you know, for a family of four to have a home and have a car and everybody gets to eat, maybe somebody goes to college, you know, what does that cost? And they wanted to keep their idea of price stability was 2%, only they decided as prices, because prices were going up, right? They were off the gold standard now for 6 years and we're seeing inflation. So what do they do in 1980? So 9 years later, they take gas and food out of the equation. Now, anybody that goes to the store now certainly understands what inflation is. You know, a loaf of bread, a good loaf of flourless, whole grain, organic bread, not bromated flour, not Wonder Bread, but...
Well, you know the thing about food? I mean, it's mind-boggling what these guys do. And we're going to have an episode on CPI, the Consumer Price Index, because there's so much misinformation in that number and so much gamesmanship, as you're indicating here. But, you know, the thing about food... When people say, boy, things are getting more expensive, they're not saying it's getting more expensive because of the TV set they just bought at Best Buy. Why? They buy one of those maybe every 5 years. Okay, they don't know. But every week they go grocery shopping.
Right.
So they okay, and every week they're seeing the prices go up because they're getting a lot of at-bats, if you will, at looking at what these prices are. Hey, how come this loaf of bread is now $6? It was, you know, $5.25 last week I was here, or, you know, and so they get to see enough things. And, you know, spending habits at the grocery store, people tend to buy the same things over and over again, you know, gallons of milk and eggs, and, you know, they start seeing this thing. And this is where they start seeing it, whether it's in the CPI or not. And the CPI, and I'll get into this when we get into the episode, is grossly understated. Grossly understated. And there's a lot of gamesmanship in terms of how they calculate it, which I won't get into now. But you just indicated one thing that is an issue. Okay. So anyway.
That's a great point, Mark. Yeah. You make an excellent point. We as consumers, not economists, we're just everyday people that are, you know, spending money at the grocery store, going to the gas pump. We see the prices go up.
I don't need an economist to tell me that prices are going up. Sorry. I don't need
that. Right. But, you know, if you, as opposed to looking at something like the price of a computer, you know, you buy it, say, anyway. But
how do you know? Yeah, right.
Okay, let's get into the structure of the Fed, because I promised an introduction to the Fed, and we're talking now.
Okay, now we're getting to the Fed. Awesome.
The meat of it. So the Federal Reserve has three main segments. They have 12 member banks, and they're located, they were initially selected, these spots were selected in 1912, by population. So the East Coast was a lot more populated than the West. So we have 12 banks. We have New York City, which is still the most powerful, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Richmond, Atlanta, Dallas, Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Kansas City, and San Francisco. Missouri is the only state with two federal reserve banks. And that just goes to show the politicking that went on, because the senator of Missouri at that time was dreadfully opposed to a federal, and they said, well, we'll give you two banks. And he said, okay. The 12 member regional banks each have a board of directors, and they control monetary policy through the 7-member board of governors in DC. So you have each of these 12 banks has a board of directors, and those, and I'm pretty sure their board of directors are a group of 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the board of governors are in Washington, D.C., and there's 7 of them. The Federal Reserve banks are private. Okay. You can't open an account at the Federal Reserve in Dallas. Okay. It's a private bank. All the Fed banks are owned by the bankers, and they buy stock in the Federal Reserve banks. Okay, so you can't buy, now you can buy stock, you can buy bank stocks, and but the Federal Reserve banks, you cannot buy stock in those. The Board of Governors in DC are made up of 7 individuals nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And they are appointed, a new governor is appointed every 2 years for a 14-year term. Now, and that, and appointed by the president, but where do you think the president gets his list? Because the Board of Governors and these member banks are, it's always bankers within that system. They're not, you know, like, they're not nominating Mark. They're not nominating Ron Paul. You know, they're nominating each other. And they put them on a list and they hand them to the president. And they try to figure out who the Congress, the Senate will allow to be confirmed.
Let's just back up here for a minute, Suzette. Mm-hmm. So you said that the 12... Federal Reserve banks that you mentioned, New York, Boston, Philly, all that, right?
Yeah.
Are independent corporations?
Yes, they are.
And you'll hear pundits say, well, you know, the Federal Reserve is really not a federal agency. Okay, true. But the fact that the president nominates the board and the members and then gets approved by the Senate, how is that any different than any other federal agency? It's not. Okay. And so the federal government has a lot of influence on these 12 banks and the people that run them. Okay. So that's just to me, a red herring when they say the Federal Reserve is not controlled by the federal government, because they are. And by the way, I had the opportunity one time to visit a lady that used to work for me, got a job at the Cleveland Federal Reserve System. So I was in Cleveland for business and I said, hey, by the way, can I do a tour? So we did an after hours tour. And this is what I saw. First of all, massive, massive amount of people. I mean, this building, it's like, okay, what do these guys do all day, right? Okay, number one, security systems. I went into the security control room and saw how they control every square inch and around it as well. They had a shooting range. Suzette, they had a shooting range. And I said, well, what do you use that for? Oh, our agents practice their shooting skills. Okay. By the way, there is something else we'll talk about another day, but how these federal agencies out there, like the EPA, the IRS, are buying ammunition and guns. And you got to ask yourself, why? Okay, well, let's get back to this. This particular Federal Reserve in Cleveland, reportedly anyway, had the biggest safe in the world. Now, it was no longer being used, but I got to see the biggest safe in the world. They wouldn't let me take a picture of it. But it was massive, okay? And I got to see them burning money. They would bring pallets of money that they wanted to take out of circulation and literally going into furnaces. I saw this, and I'm like, okay, well, now I'm a climate change zealot. It's like, you're going to really pollute the air. You should just let me take that stuff off your hands.
I'll take that on for you.
All of a sudden, I'm a climate change zealot, right? And but they were burning skids and skids and skids, 4x4s, like a Gaylord, 4x4x4 skids of money. They're burning right in front of my very eyes. Millions and millions of dollars they're burning right in front of me. But this thing was incredible to see. And it's like, oh, my God, look at what we created. And this was only one of them, Suzette. Okay? There's only one of them. And look at what we created here. The monstrosity that we created. Shooting range and all. So anyway, I just thought I'd deviate and let you know that I had some experience of going to see what these setups look like.
So that's very, very interesting. And the fact that they have a shooting range,
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So we're getting a picture. So let's talk about the stock in these private banks, these 12 member banks. So there are no individual stockholders. The actual stock is owned by the member banks, which are required to subscribe to the stock of the Federal Reserve. So they have to buy stock, and it has to be for each district. So San Francisco, Cleveland, et cetera. They have to take about 6% of whatever their capital and surplus is. So say they have $1 million in their bank, they have to take 6% of that and buy stock with it in the Federal Reserve System. Every nationally chartered bank in America is required by law to keep 6% of its capital in their regional member bank. So they have to keep 6% of their money. So now all of the little banks that aren't member banks, but like say your local county bank, they have to keep 6% of their money in that member bank. And in return, that private bank receives an equivalent amount of shares in the regional reserve bank. So it gets a, I realize I'm going into the weeds here, but the reason
it's really important, and there's some principles here that we need to talk about, but go ahead.
The important thing here is that they keep saying we're not profit oriented. And it's, if they were not making profit, they would not be doing this. Trust me. This is what JP Morgan saw right out of the gate. This is a great way to make money. And these central banks, the Central Bank of England, Central Bank of the Netherlands, they knew what they were doing. And if you're a bank.
If I'm located in, let's say, Springfield, Massachusetts, as a bank, I'm beholden then probably to a region, in this case, probably be Boston, right? So I can't buy a stock of, I can't put my money into Chicago or to Los Angeles or something like that, or San Francisco, I mean. I got to be beholden to the, I have to invest in my region. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So so if you're a national, you're a bank in Springfield, yes, you would, you're in that area.
If I'm in that region for Boston, I got to invest in Boston, 6%.
Exactly.
Now let's talk about a couple of things here from a pure Adam Smith free market system. What corporation do you know out there today in the private sector that compels people to buy stock? Can General Electric, for example, say you have to buy 6% of my stock?
No.
Okay. So right there, there's a principle missing here with the free market, correct?
Correct. So,
is this not extortion? I mean, think about
it. It's pay to play, baby.
It's pay to play. Okay. Because one thing you'll probably get into is the whole prime rate, where the prime rate is the interest rate that the Federal Reserve lends to these banks that just gave them 6% of their equity. Okay.
Right. So that would be, well, let's address it now. So I'm the little community bank in Springfield, Mass, and I need, somebody has a big project. They've come in and they want to borrow money to build something.
Right.
And they tick all the boxes for me. And, you know, so I need now like $2 million that I need to, or these days, $2 billion that I need to borrow from the Boston Fed. And so I go to that, I go to their, what they call the discount window. So the Federal Reserve has a discount rate for its member banks. So I go to their, to my local Federal Reserve bank, member bank, and I go to the discount window and I borrow money. And they decide, all those people that you saw in Cleveland, one of those was making a decision about whether that $2 billion was going to get approved. And that probably went up a chain of quite an extensive chain of scrutiny to decide whether that bank was getting that money. And when that bank did get the money, of course, they got it at the discount rate. And now they're going to loan it out to Bob, who's building this $2 billion complex shopping center, something. They don't build those anymore, but they used to build them like crazy. And he has he's going to sell that loan essentially at whatever the rate is. So he borrows at 4%. He loans it out at 8%. He's now earning 4% on his money. So that's how banks operate. So the rates are fixed. The bank, so we kind of get the idea of how that works. And the real power, the thing about the Fed is the real power players are the Board of Governors in DC. These are the guys that are really running the bank. And I would also say, never forget, if you wanted to do an assignment, and I have this on my list of assignments as kind of an aside, look at every Treasury Secretary we've had and show me one that was not on either the Federal Reserve Board or on one of the directors at the Federal Reserve member banks. I just would like to know one that is not part of the club. And they are our Treasury Secretary. So now the Federal Reserve has extended its tentacles directly into the government. So,
boy, that just sounds like the military industrial complex, where Lloyd Austin, who is Biden's defense secretary, was on the board for Raytheon. Well, that's incredible how that works, huh?
So it's quite the mess. So the most profitable year for the Fed up until now was 2015, and they earned a net income of $100.2 billion. Okay, so they're creating money with credit cards. They're selling treasury bonds.
Right.
They're getting paid interest on the money that they're creating out of thin air.
And they're using the 6% equity that these banks have to invest in.
Well, they get paid back.
They make money on it.
They get, well, and then, but they also, those member banks get, so here's what happens. So they made in 2015, from what I understand, and I'm sure there are caveats to this, they made $102.2 billion, and of that money, $97.7 billion was transferred to the U.S. Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
So the Treasury's mm-hmm. okay with the Federal Reserve system. Mm-hmm. They're like, mm-hmm. Pretty good. We don't have to do anything for this.
Let me just deviate a little bit, just for a second, on what we talked about in our constitutional economics episode way back when we first started this podcast. Mm-hmm. And people need to understand what is inflation, okay? Inflation, people think, oh, that's when prices go up at the grocery store. Okay, well, no, not really. There is a money supply out there. I know you're going to get into this in a minute. And, you'll hear M2, M1, all kinds of different classifications of money. But there's a money supply, which means how much money is out there in the system of our currency today. And a lot of this money, by the way, isn't just paper currency. It's stuff that's in a computer. And when you look at your bank account and you pull up your account online, it might say you have $10,000 in your bank. That is part of the money supply. Now, I want you to think about the money supply no different than you think about any other commodity, okay? So let's just take tomatoes. There's a certain amount of tomatoes out there right now. That is the market for tomatoes. Same thing with automobiles, same thing with housing, okay? Now, when the demand for any of these products goes up, the price will go up. Why? Because there's greater competition and greater demand for tomatoes. More people want tomatoes? Well, guess what? I can raise the price because I know I'm going to sell them. It's very simple, supply and demand curve. Now, let's just say there's not a lot of tomatoes out there today and people still want tomatoes, so there's a high demand. Well, guess what? The price is going to go up, right? Because everybody's fighting for those few tomatoes that are out there. The money supply is no different, okay? So the more money that's out there, like tomatoes, the less they're worth. It's absolutely no different whatsoever.
In this system. In the inflationary system, which they call inflation, the hidden tax. So the Federal Reserve, inherent in that inflation is a tax.
Right, because you're 10,000, let's just say you had 10% inflation in 1 year as a number. Just pick that out of the air. But, and you have $10,000 in the bank on January 1st, and you still have $10,000 at the end of the year. It's now worth $9,000 in terms of its purchasing power.
And yeah, they just told it. And by the way, that
$10,000, by the way, was already taxed by the government. Okay. And so think about this. Okay. It is the worst tax there is out there. The most inhumane tax is inflation. So I wanted to bring that up in terms of the money supply is no different. And literally, now that we're not in the gold standard and we don't have to keep our money supply at the same level of our gold reserves, they can, what we call, print money. And it's not really printing money per se, as you would know, printing a newspaper. It's just actually making an entry into the system that says, I got $1 trillion more. Okay. Now there's $1 trillion more in the system. The Federal Reserve now can go and do what they will with that, lend it to the banks. They can lend it to the government and, you know, and all that. They can do all this stuff. Okay. They could buy treasury bonds, right? By printing money, by simply going to a computer and saying, okay, I've got $1 trillion more now to play with. What kind of great business is that? Think about it.
Oh. I mean,
when you manufacture that microphone that you're talking into, that producer has material, labor, overhead cost, insurance, labor, everything, right?
Well, design. Guess what?
Design
costs. He's got to market it.
Exactly.
He's got to get it to the public so people can look at it and decide if they want it.
Supply chain costs, transportation, design. All that that goes into that one little microphone you're talking into right now, okay? The Federal Reserve? Nothing. Nothing, okay?
And it's all secret. And they like to say private, but it's secret. Now, I know in 2015, they had their best year ever. That was the time they sent the most, over $100 billion to the U.S.
By the way, there is stuff that's going on that's not reported. So, you know, we don't even know the half of what's going on there. But I just wanted to give a little bit of sense of what inflation is and how the Federal Reserve makes their money. And it's, you know, and eventually it comes back to the taxpayer in terms of this inflation. And it also comes back to the taxpayer in terms of funding the spending that the government does because of the ability to print money. Okay. This COVID spending, all this stuff, all this, these $1 trillion packages, these stimulus packages, which is a joke of a name. We pay for that, Suzette.
Through inflation.
And through taxes. We have to pay for it sooner or later.
Yep. Taxes and the hidden tax, the cruelest tax, the hidden tax in the inflation.
Exactly.
I mean, it's crazy. And taking away the ability to barter is a huge red flag. It's a huge red flag because what it's saying is that you have to play ball in our court by our rules.
Yeah. And
you want to step out of the system, the benevolence, your story about your grandfather,
that benevolence now has been basically economically, surgically removed from our society. Okay. There's no longer any incentive to do stuff like that, or less incentive, I should say, because now there's a cost to it. The cost that didn't exist before. Okay. Anyway, I'll stop there. But I just want to let people know what the Fed does with and how they print money and how this is controlling everything we're doing. And there's a lot more to say about this, but I just want to throw that out there one more time just so that people understand how this all works. Okay. And there's so much more to say about this that we'll get into in other episodes. So
in the short story is that price stability and employment and there was a third tenet that the 77 Federal Reserve Act, the amendment to the Reserve Act included, they've totally failed because inflation's not 2%. inflation, according to John Williams, inflation is at least whatever they say inflation is, it's at least 6 to 8% more.
Right.
And that's conservative.
And so, by the way, we will talk about the Depression era because because you're going to see, I should call it the Depression error, not era, error, right? You'll see how the Fed and FDR prolonged the Depression for 10 years, for a decade. And we'll tie that back to what you're talking about. You'll find out that the Fed had a lot to do with the 2008 crash. You're going to find the Fed had a lot to do with almost every economic downturn we've had. The Fed was complicit. And we'll get into all that in future episodes. Sorry.
So for the Fed, who likes to say they don't operate on profit, in 2017, they sent $80 billion to the U.S. Treasury, and they paid out $13.8 billion to their regular banks, to their Fed member banks in bank stocks.
A great deal.
You have 12 banks. They each got over $1 billion, depending on how many stocks they had. And, you know, so, yeah, they're definitely in the money making business in more ways, not just money printing, but money making. Who are the shareholders of the Fed? Every banker in America. It's a 150-page document with all banks. So they're all, and that is something you can buy. You can buy stock in your community bank. If you want to enrich your oppressors, I would encourage you to do so. If you want to push back, I would encourage you to cut your own lawn. But that's just me. So I want to talk about, the money supply. People often say, what is the money supply? Well, the money supply is what the central bank does, essentially. It regulates money in circulation. So there are the authority for issuing coins and notes, the money and the money supply, that's what they do. They issue money, they print money, they keep, and they do it in a couple ways. They control it. They have something called MO, M1, M2, and M3. So Mark, we've talked about like the structure of the bank and bank profits, even though they say they don't have bank profits, and how the role of the Federal Reserve has changed over these last, well, over 100 years now. It's been 110 years last year. They came about in 1913.
Yeah, it has.
Would you mind explaining to everybody what actually happens to the money that we put in the bank? I get paid, it goes into the bank. What happens next?
Hey, by the way, when you put it in that perspective, being over 100 years, and we look back at the economic calamity that we had over those 100 years and plus 100 years, and you ask yourself, wait a minute, isn't that what the Fed was supposed to avert?
Oh, yeah, they've been an abject failure, except if you're a member bank and you're making money.
Oh, no, there's always winners. There's always winners. It just won't be you, okay? That's the thing the American people need to understand. Why do we have all these economic collapses, 2008? Why do we have the Depression? Okay, so we will get into that in more detail in future episodes. But your question was, hey, what happens to this $100 you put in the bank? Well, first of all, when you go to make a deposit into a bank, more than likely that money's already been taxed, right? Let's say it's your paycheck, okay? So now the government took a piece of your money. Now you're putting that rest of that into the bank or whatever you deem you want to put into the bank, because you do need to buy things like gasoline and groceries that the Fed doesn't think is important to put into the CPI. Okay. And when you put money in the bank, without getting into all the math and the gory details, the banks are going to make money on your money. And sooner or later, it finds its ugly way into the Federal Reserve System, which they end up depositing into the U.S. Treasury. So that money, the money that's earned on your money, gets back into the Treasury. So on your money that's already been taxed, you are feeding the government again with your deposits into the banking system. Okay, so, and you don't get a credit for that, Suzette. So, you know, you've already been taxed on your money. You have $100 now to put into the bank. They go in, they make a bunch of money on it, and it goes back into the Treasury through the Fed. And that money that got credited to the federal government never shows up as a credit to you. Okay. So again, I want to take us back to a little bit bigger picture here. You opened up this episode by talking about Thomas Jefferson and why he was against this. And there were a number of reasons, but you mentioned control. Okay. This is a way the government can control you. Okay. And it also flies flat in the face of the Constitution, where it says the people don't work for the government works for the people. Well, guess what? Through the 16th Amendment, which is the income tax amendment, right? We are working for the government. And I'm not talking about government employees.
It's enslavement. And it's a different kind of enslavement. It's perhaps an invisible chain.
It's a sliding
hand. If you
don't
feel it, if you're unaware of it, if you just think prices are going up or you don't make enough money and the minimum wage should be $20 instead of whatever it is, it's an invisible chain. And Thomas Jefferson was painfully aware of it. We know about physical enslavement and how abhorrent that is. I mean, we just don't like that. Free people should be free to feel and think and speak as they wish. And they should be free to labor and keep the fruits of their labor. And this idea that everything is regulated through we know that things are regulated through the money. And that is why when I was a kid, my understanding was every good trade involves a little money. Now that's a very different mindset than today, where, you know, people don't even want it. It's all about the money.
But you think about it.
Like you can, you know what I mean? Like say you're trading something like we were talking about with the bartering, like washing the windows. You know, or you were bringing up the tomatoes. Like, so say I am really good at growing tomatoes and my family needs 50 quarts of tomatoes a year. And so I grow a bunch of tomatoes and I put up my 50 quarts and now I have 30 extra quarts. And so I trade those with Bob, who's really good at growing potatoes. And his family needs, you know, a couple hundred pounds of potatoes and he has extra. So we exchange that. And maybe we see, you know, since he's got a bumper crop of potatoes, the potatoes aren't as valuable as the tomatoes. So we throw in something like, well, I'll trim that tree in your front yard, you know, or I'll give you an extra $10.
But you see, in that case, though, you and Bob are deciding what's equitable, okay? When the government's making money on money that you were already taxed and you don't get any of that back, you don't get anything back for it, okay? You're getting more government spending and more inflation, okay? And so that's the fundamental problem that Jefferson, I believe, had in terms of being able to look at how power and control will violate the fundamental notion of our unique way of government, and that was a big deal, and again I want to go back to the Federal Reserve being complicit in everything that we've had economically, okay, and the economic calamity. And of late, we had printed trillions and trillions of dollars with the respect of the government's going to save us from COVID. Okay. So we just created spending through the roof. Right. And what did that do? As I just exclaimed a little bit earlier, that was the definition of inflation. Our money got inflated. There's more money out there chasing less goods. So the price of those goods go up because the dollar's worth less. It's not worth a dollar anymore, 100 cents. It's worth, you know, 85 cents. So by definition, things are going to go up. Now, there's other factors that drive price, okay? I understand that. But the biggest influence on this thing called inflation is the expansion of the money supply. That is inflation. So with that being said, what does the Fed do? And this is today in 2024 and in 2023. Oh, our inflation rates are too high. So we have to raise interest rates so that we depress the economy, which brings down the demand for goods and services, and that will bring prices down. Well, that's really nice. In the meantime, you're putting people out of work because there's less demand for goods and services. Okay, you're creating unemployment, which the government has to pay for anyway, okay? And if you're fixated on that one number, then you'll be successful in bringing down inflation. But the collateral damage will be deafening, right? It would be awful, and it is awful what's going on. And I believe that we're on the top of a roller coaster waiting to crash, the housing market, everything. So I kind of look at it this way. The Federal Reserve created the inflation through government spending, the appetite for government spending. And I look at our government as complicit as them. Now they want to try to fix inflation. Well, my simple-minded question is, why did you create it to begin with if it's a bad thing? You know it's going to happen. You talked about history, Suzette, and you talked about, well, Jefferson and the crowd there learned from history, okay? We don't know that printing money is going to cause inflation. We don't know that there's going to be after the euphoria of the spending, which we've been through, it will crash. We don't know that. It only happened a million times before, but let's not look back at history, right? Because we're different. Okay.
Mark, you know, when you say euphoria of spending, you're not kidding.
No.
When you spend money or you say you gamble on Wall Street and you get lucky and you hit the jackpot, your stock goes up, you make money, you're able to then sell it. Because a lot of times your stock will go up and you try to sell it and you can't sell it. I don't know if you've ever had that experience.
Oh, yeah.
But say you do sell it, you make this money, even just say you never get to collect the reward. You just see that it went up, you know, because you just look when you get your statement every 30 days or 90 days or whatever it is. That actually stimulates the dopamine receptors in the brain.
Yes, it does.
And you do get that. That is an addictive. That's the same part of the brain that gets stimulated when you snort cocaine. Same thing, that sense of empowerment, euphoria, that excitement, you know, that is connected to that. And it happens when we spend.
And when you're getting money from the government for doing nothing, God, the spending and the euphoria that you indicated, you know, so here's my analogy, Suzette. I'm a very simple person when it comes to this. The Fed created inflation. Now they're trying to cure inflation, okay? And you got to ask yourself the question, well, why did you create it to begin with if it's such a bad thing to do? You know damn well expanding the money supply is inflation. Okay. And to put it in layman's terms, I kind of look at it like, okay, I want credit for taking my dog to the vet, but I'm the one that beat my dog to begin with. Okay.
Right.
I beat my dog. Now I want you to pat me on the back because I'm going to save the day and save his life by taking him to the vet. It doesn't work that way. Okay. And so while these people, and you alluded to this earlier, while these people at the Fed are doing all this, they're making money hand over fist. Okay. So there is no incentive for the Federal Reserve to keep the money supply in control. There is absolutely zero incentive to do it. Zero. Okay. There is zero incentive for a healthy America, and there is zero incentive to have peace. And go back to the military-industrial complex. So that's something I want to think about here. And we're going to get more, Suzette, we're going to get more involved in all of this. I think you did a great job in explaining who these guys were and why it came to be, okay, and what the Federal Reserve is. Because I think most Americans, and to your point earlier, they don't get taught this in school, okay? They don't get taught this in school, okay? And And, you know, I think we have to look at the bigger picture here. Capitalism, and in particular, American capitalism, is the one biggest thing in the way of the globalists right now. We have the biggest economy in the world, and we are right now a capitalistic society, but we are the biggest thing in the world. And I want to go back to Lenin, where he said he had a 3-point plan to bring communism into Europe, which he did, into Asia, which he did, and into the United States, which they're doing. That was his 3-point plan. And if you don't tell me that climate change and all these other assaults on our economy and our people are part of that, you're going to have to go a long way to explain that to me, because to me, the Federal Reserve was created by globalists and it's being run by globalists. Okay. And by the way, on both sides of the aisle. So maybe we leave it at that. And I think we can get into all the other transgressions in subsequent episodes, but I'll leave you with the last word.
I'd like to close with a quote from Mark Twain.
Ah.
It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so.
I love it.
Okay? It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so.
Is that the definition of ignorance?
That's Mark Twain, baby. And that's, you know, like, I would encourage everyone, like, watch The Big Short, find that movie and watch it. And you might have to watch it a couple times to kind of understand it. It's very fast moving, not unlike it. It really reflects how this Wall Street banking system operates. And it's amazing. And I would encourage that. And if you ever want to pick up a book that you can turn to when you're in the mood to understand more about money, there's a good series by Mike Maloney on YouTube that's the history of money. That's a very good thing, I think, for people to understand, because your banker has watched it. So you may want to watch it too. Don't be, as Thomas Jefferson said, don't be the gull. So I'll leave it. Don't be gullible. So I'll
I think the economic acumen of America is very poor. And that's,
we can change that, you know, and you don't have to go to college to learn it. All you need is to be diligent, to study some of this information. Use, when you find a word you don't understand, ask someone or look it up on Google. That's what I use Google for.
You know, Susan, I've taken many economic courses I have 2 undergraduate degrees in business. I have an MBA, but I learned more about economics on my own than I have in school, even with those degrees. Okay. There's nothing to stop us from learning.
Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing to stop us from learning. And I think we're obligated as citizens to become informed and to educate ourselves on this stuff. So anyway, Suzette, nice job on this. We're going to have more about this in the future, because we're going to get into the depression. We're going to, you mentioned the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. We're going to have an episode on that. We're going to have at least one episode on the gold standard. And by the way, there is this whole destruction or elimination of the gold standard in 1972 by Nixon was percolated decades before. Okay. That's one thing about the Marxists and the globalists, is that they'll work slow. It's like the frog in cold water. You turn up the water, he doesn't know he's being boiled, and sooner or later he's gone. So stay tuned. Suzette, great job on this.
Thank you. And
my only regret in life is I wasn't able to grab that money off that pallet while the Cleveland Federal Reserve was burning all that money. Anyway, but we'll see you next time for Suzette Lawrence in Sedona, and Mark DeLuzio in Scottsdale, which is warmer here than it is where you are. So
yes, it is. It's 52 and windy. Take care, everyone. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Suzette. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to The Constitution Solution, one podcast under God. where we hold that strict adherence to the Constitution is the solution to most of our country's problems.
You can find other episodes on our website at 1787solution.com, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other platforms. We're your hosts, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. Until next time, may God bless you and may God bless America.